Welcome to We Cut Heads, a spiky podcast. I'm your host, Spencer, and with me is Joel. No dumb intro this time. This is a special episode, secret episode. I don't know. It's at the end of, we're almost done, so rules could kind of go out the door.
You've got senioritis.
Yeah, I got senioritis real bad. Because, like, kind of a look behind the curtain. We're going to record, I think, 5 or 6 more episodes before we're done. Something like that. And I did promise we might be doing the Passover spike thing, which I don't know if we'll get to that or not. But we might get to that. But so this is a episode on an African film that I'm a big fan of. Can you hear my cat?
I just heard a meow, yeah.
Nope. I can. I heard that.
Right when I said they're calm.
African film.
A special episode. African film that I'm a big fan of that I never heard of until our guest. Mentioned it to me, I can't remember when, but at some point.
It might have been, we've talked about a few African films, like former French colonial West African films a couple of times. It probably came up in one of those conversations, like, oh, you know, there's also this movie, but I'm sure it's come up in the past. Yeah.
Really? And so, guest, who are you? What are you doing here?
I'm Martin Kessler over from FlixWise. I'm here to talk about Telai by Idrissa Ouedraogo.
Okay. Thank you for saying the name.
That's the best I can do.
I sure. But, okay, so. So, Martin, how did you first hear about Telai?
Well, I did a series of articles covering Russian filmmaker Alexei Garman's whole career, and I didn't want to just do an overview of the films he directed, because sometimes there's like over a decade-long gap between some of his film projects. He didn't have very many films that he directed, even though it's a very impressive body of work, but I was interested also in stuff he had written and stuff he had produced and films by his students, and also just films that he had championed to kind of, you know, fill out and understand that whole career. And that's how I first found out about this film, because Alexei Garman was on the jury for the 1990 Cannes Film Festival. And it was pretty contentious. He's sort of a famously stubborn filmmaker, so he got into some arguments with other people on the jury. I think most notably... Bernardo Bertolucci, I'm pretty sure, was the head of the jury that year. And the two would fight constantly. Supposedly, at one point, after arguing, Bertolucci got up and he was in tears. And he said, "You're just poisoning me because I'm a former communist," and ran off crying. And they argued about everything, apparently. And that year, the film that won the Palme d'Or was Wild at Heart, which Alexei Garman didn't really like that much. And Telai was the film that he was championing to win. So that's where I first heard about it. And apparently after Telai didn't get the Palme d'Or, Alexei Garman went up to Idrissa Ouedraogo and he was like, "I'm sorry, we squeezed your movie out of the award it deserved, but here's a bottle of vodka," and gave it to him. So that was one film I know that he championed and backed, so I was like, oh, I might as well check this out, because I hadn't heard of it before. And it's weird to sort of find a film that was nominated for the Palme d'Or that you're like, oh, I've never even heard of this. So I managed to find a copy, and I thought it was really great. It definitely lived up to that setup of reading the awards backstory. And I like it, that It's a pretty short film, but it's very economic storytelling. You feel like every scene kind of forwards something or adds something. It doesn't feel like it's just sort of meandering. And I guess I can explain the story or the plot if you'd like.
Well, first, I want to ask Joel, before I told you we're doing this, had you heard of this movie?
Actually, yeah, I'm a huge fan of... of
course, you surprised me sometimes.
I wasn't expecting that.
Yeah. I'm sorry, this is not one that I'd heard of, other than showing up probably on my letterbox because you'd reviewed it last year.
Okay.
Well, but that's I can't think of another situation where I...
Okay. Well, since this is your first viewing of it, how would you describe this movie? How would you sum up like this story?
It's got all the drama of your average old school Jerry Springer production. Man okay. loves woman. Woman loves man. Man's father marries that woman. Man is pissed off. Man's brother is like, I don't know. You know,
yeah,
and then some killing, you know, a little bit of murder, and at least two, count them, two donkeys.
Two separate donkeys.
That's true.
Written in a way that I don't usually see, which is like right on the back end of the donkey.
Yeah. I was, lean back like a low rider.
You got that whole donkey ahead of you. Yeah. That.
So did you like the movie? J-Dog?
Oh, yeah. I definitely liked it, yeah. Okay. Because it wasn't... I really like the style that I feel like more than one of the African films that we've watched where it's just laying it out, and it's so funny. I watched it with Sarah, of course, and she was like, the way these people are talking to each other where they just kind of like state exactly what they're thinking... And whether or not somebody has insulted them like that, that's the way you talk to your family. I was like, I guess.
I always thought like the...
like, did you do this thing? Yes.
Like there's something okay. a little bit like Robert Bresson in that style where it's like so kind of plain and understated. And like, I really like that the actors aren't trying to play things up for drama. They just kind of state whatever it is. And yeah. like, I think it works really, really well. It kind of gives it this low key... subtlety that I think works really well for it. Like one of my favorite moments is there's the second guy with the donkey, the guy who just gives the leading lady a ride. At the end, like you sort of find out that, you know, he's like got a crush on her, I guess, or he's sort of saying like, hey, you know, why don't you just come with me? And she's like, I can't. My heart belongs to another. He's like, yeah, okay, I understand. Bye. Then, like, that's it.
Oh, yeah.
And then, yeah.
Yeah, it's the, you know, it's the mystery method. It's a numbers game, okay? You just, sometimes a woman stays with you on the donkey. Most of the time,
but
they
he
take
says
off.
It in such a blunt way that, like, it's so perfect. And there's, I think, like, a sense of humor in this film, too, that it's very, very deadpan, but it kind of evens out with some of that really dark stuff. Like, there's some death and some... taboo subjects, but I guess we'll get into all of that.
Like my favorite funny moment is when the dad was talking to brother, and brother says, "What an ass!"
Yeah,
and it sticks out so much because like the movie is not that vulgar. It's just like one is shocking too. It's like it's generally funny having the brother like react that much. Because he's pretty, like he's pretty trying not to like be too in favor of anyone's side, so he's kind of like emotionally in the middle.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's funny too.
He's undecided.
I always think
voter.
Like whenever people do these period dramas, they tend to sanitize the dialogue in a way that, like, I think people don't always realize that. Yeah, it was common, basically in any culture in the past to. Swear casually like the way people would swear today, and I sort of appreciate it, even though it's like not really vulgar, the dialogue, there's like just some profanity that's kind of thrown in there that makes it feel really sort of present, and that's one thing I also really like about it. I'm not sure when it's meant to be set exactly, like it's pre-colonial Burkina Faso, which is just south of Mali, which we talked about on the Timbuktu episode, but
So it would have been the Mossy Kingdoms, one of Pomona Kingdoms,
And like, even though
I think, in the Mossy.
like he's got that I think it's like a flintlock rifle. It's sort of hard to tell on my version because you don't really get a close up, but it's like an older, like 1700s kind of rifle, but it looks like it's meant to be old by this point. So I'm guessing like maybe 1880s, 1890s, this might be meant to be set.
The French probably got there like 18. I'm not too sure when the French got
I
there,
think
but
like
like
late
I think
1890s, like it's fairly late compared to some of the other nations that were colonized, but I think probably like late-ish 19th centuries, I'm guessing when this is meant to
yeah,
be set.
it would have been that time because the British were kind of lingering for a long time before that. The French were other myth, like they were kind of went in by force very
And
quickly.
it's also the community that you're watching in the film, this Mossy village, it's meant to be fairly isolated at the same time, so like you don't know, there could be other stuff going on in the wider world that just doesn't come into the story. And it's sort of interesting, like one of the things the film was actually kind of criticized for when it first came out is not really dealing with colonial themes. But that's, to me, one thing that's kind of interesting about it is it feels like very insular in a specifically African story, and it's not necessarily that concerned with addressing these colonial powers in a way that feels like it's trying to engage with them. It's just like, hey, we're going to make this story for ourselves, kind of a feeling to it, which I liked.
It's refreshing, and also like a year or two before had that Thimbin movie, Camp Villeroy. I'm learning French, so I should be able to say it, but I'm still not sure. But like that like movie is all about colonialism, and as this feels like coming out like around the same time here, it's like it's a nice counterpoint in terms of scale, and like just not really addressing, not like dealing with that, just dealing with like other stuff
Yeah,
too.
and I feel like you can still probably look at this film in the grander scheme of colonial analysis by saying like it's interesting that it's showing a period in Africa where there isn't a colonial power yet, it hasn't been totally impacted by colonialism yet, and telling a story from that period, it like in that way it also kind of might fit into a colonial interpretation, but it seems like a specific choice not to kind of engage with that time period or with those subjects.
Yeah, and how do you guys want to go about this? Just like talk about character by character, or like theme by theme, like how you guys want to go about this?
I can sort of work through the plot and we can kind of figure out what to jump in on if that works,
Okay, yeah, that works.
or whatever you'd like. It's
Okay, so the thing, this is the second time I've seen it, and the opening really struck me this time because you get, because the opening is, like I said earlier, it's very economic, and in the first five, basically first 5 minutes, you get the lead, Saha, I guess, how do you say it? Saga, something
Saha,
like
yeah,
that.
it's written in the subtitles as Saga, but it's they seem to pronounce it like Saha.
And he's arriving back to his home village, and he's alone. And so, so you get the feeling, some people get the feeling of like, okay, he's been gone for some amount of time, you're not really sure. And you get the view of the village, and it looks like the shot in Playtime. The view of the office, and like, but in this case, like the view of the village is like setting you up, like the classic, classic thing of like visually showing you where majority of the movie will take place, and showing you like, who's who, not who's who, but like get the setting, you get the main character, and then, he announces himself. And you see And then quickly after you get like a conflict, which is the woman that he loves appears, and like it's just like it's so economical in the first 5 minutes of setting up everything, and it's almost entirely silent.
Yeah, I mean, we should say this film, I think it's only about 80 minutes, and it doesn't need to be any longer than that. Like, you feel like you just found out exactly the right amount of time to tell this story, and it's partly through that visual storytelling and that economic storytelling. The beginning, to me, kind of made me think a little bit of like spaghetti westerns, like Clint Eastwood on the donkey at the beginning of Fistful of Dollars, and it kind of sets it up. I guess in a way it is an outlaw story, like it's a little bit like a Lovers on the Run kind of story at some points, and it made me think a little bit of like to some extent to films like Badlands, and it kind of has that element to it. It's just done in an unconventional way, and it's sort of funny, like, again, the Cannes Film Festival that this was up against Wild at Heart, which is another Lovers on the Run kind of outlaw story, but like, you know, they couldn't be more different in their approach.
Yeah, and Gabriel Diop-Mbeti, he is in the credits. I didn't translate what, but like it said something like from Senegal or of Senegal. So I think maybe he contributed he either helped production, but I believe this is the movie he did a behind the scenes documentary of.
Oh, I haven't seen that. That'd be really interesting.
I think this is the movie. It's either this or another movie that Drago did, but it's one of his lost movies, like pretty much everything but like the four that are available.
Yeah,
I've been looking for it for a couple of years, but
because I think I mean, so many, like, this movie wasn't easy to find, but compared to a lot of African cinema, this was easy to find, you know. I think now, like, you could probably even find it on YouTube, or I think it's on Canopy, so people can even watch it for free if they're listening to this and think, like, oh, geez, I'd like to see that film. But the financing, I'm pretty sure it had a little bit of money come in from, like, all over. Like, I think France and Switzerland and you know, a couple of places, I think, is where the financing came from. So it's multinational kind of production.
Maybe even Senegal because of the Mbeti connection.
Yeah, it could be. And like, I know Idrissa Ouedraogo, he talked a little bit about this ambition to have like a pan-African cinema, and this idea that, you know, individually the African countries were somewhat limited in their production and in their markets, but as a continent together, these films, you know, they could be, they could have a lot of weight thrown behind them, both in production and in distribution, if you know, these African countries work together in filmmaking. And I know, like, aside from film, a lot of his career he spent teaching other filmmakers, and I think, like, that was important to him, not just making his films, but sort of growing a film community in Africa. And so, I don't know if you guys know, I tried to find out, I really tried to dig into this, but there's other Ouedraogos in the cast, and I was wondering if they were related. I thought maybe they were related to each other, because like the two brothers are both Ouedraogo, and I think I think the mother and the father are also Ouedraogo last name, so like I'm not sure if that was a family and they happen to have the same last name as the director, or if they were his family, or what exactly. I don't know if you guys know anything about that. I was just curious.
I was curious too, because I saw it come up. Like, I'm not sure if it's a common name or like maybe he got family to help out, but who knows? But going back to like the beginning of the film, like it feels like the whole setup, it feels theatrical. It feels like a stripped down version of a play.
Yeah. I know, like, Richard Brody did a review of the film that came out after I'd written about it, so I felt like I beat a couple of people to the punch, but I think that had more to do with the fact that Idrissa Ouedraogo died in 2018, so, like, people started looking at his work. But Richard Brody compared it, I think, to some of these classic Greek tragedies, which I could definitely see. It sort of feels like it's setting that stage, and it feels like, you know, that you could compare it to something like Oedipus Rex, or, you know, you can find those kinds of themes in it. And it's definitely a tragedy, this story. So that theatrical quality, yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense, yeah.
And, like, the ending, I remember the very, very end, but I didn't remember, like, right before, which, spoiler, when the brother kills Saha. Mm-hmm. But, like, I forgot just how much of a gut punch that ending is. Yeah. Like, it legitimately ruined my mood hour today after getting to that part.
I did not find it to be a gut punch.
You did it?
I found it. At that point, it was because there were so many things that happened in this movie where I was like, if you're going to do that, this is going to, oh, okay, you went and did that. Now this is, oh no, you did that. This is going to happen. Oh, okay. It's like watching a horror movie or, you know, don't go in that room kind of thing. And at the end, when the brother shows up to, you know, mourn his mother, or when Saha shows up to mourn his recently passed mother, and the father's like to the brother, like, you're exiled, like, get out of here. I was like, he should pick up that gun and shoot his brother, like, because this is basically all his. Oh, he did. Okay, well, there you go.
Yeah, but still.
And then, you know, yeah, seeing the, it was satisfying to me that we got to see his wife or whatever show up at the end with the aunt and be like, oh, let's keep going. But we didn't actually see what happened to them, because it was just going to be another disaster.
And there's so many things that are kind of left ambiguous in the film too, but it's very selective what it chooses to be ambiguous about. And, like, I don't, for instance, the I think it's sort of implied that Noma, she's pregnant, but I think she's probably pregnant with the guy with the donkey's baby. Like, the way that scene is done, it doesn't come right out and say it, but there's, like, enough of a hint. And when Saha asks her, like, oh yeah, is the baby mine? And she's like, yeah, sure. You know, like, there's a couple things like that where, like, I'm glad it didn't come out and say it, but it sort of lingers in the back of your mind, and you know, you're kind of left to think about some of the elements of the story after it's already ended. Like, also the ending has one of my biggest laughs in the film, when Saha shows back up at the village to mourn his dead mother, and, like, everyone thinks he's dead because, like, originally his brother was selected to kill him. They drew straws, and he went to his tent and or his hut, and he made it look like, oh, I got hurt and he got away, and he burns the hut down, and everyone thinks that Saha is dead. So when he shows up at the end, they're like, oh, that's not Saha, that's his ghost, and all the old men run off. Like, for whatever, I don't know, that part just made me laugh. Or, like, there's a couple, like, very deadpan, like, head-on kind of shots that are, they're, I think, like, clearly meant to be funny the way it's done. But do you guys want to talk about the teeth sucking and disapproval gesture that comes up throughout?
Yeah, like, this time it really stuck out, because I guess I don't think I noticed the first time I saw it. This time it really did, like, I noticed, like, oh, a lot of people are doing
that. Yeah, anytime there's, like, some kind of disapproval, it's like, I don't know, I just thought it was, like, a really great gesture. I don't know if it's more common, a gesture there, but it's like, you know exactly what it means, and it's just funny to see, like, you use that much.
Like, I think I first noticed with the teen, I guess she's supposed to be a teen, a little sister doing it. So, I forgot how much fun that character was.
The sarcastic little sister.
Because, like, even though this is like a pretty heavy movie, like there's still enough lightness so it's not doesn't feel like oppressive or like that difficult. And like with her, that character's like, it's like she's also just a kid, and she acts like a kid, and she never like acts like it never feels false. It's always feel like, oh yeah, of course, like a teen would act like this.
Even just like the sneaking around, like she's helping her older sister, because there's the section of the film early on where her sister's married to Saha's father, but she and Saha love each other. So Noama, I keep wanting to say Noama, I think it's Noma. They're sneaking around behind everyone's back and sleeping together, and the younger sister's helping to cover by being like, oh yeah, she's visiting auntie, and when she's getting a hard time, and she just like sneaks off, and there's one part where you can tell like she's just so happy to be sneaking around. It's really funny. And I don't, and then eventually when they finally catch her, they're like, oh yeah, she's visiting auntie, and it's like, no, auntie's right here. It's like the kid who's been caught staying out late. But in this case, there's lethal consequences, like her father kills himself, and Saha's father tries to have his son killed because of it, because of this, it's basically incest, because his father's married the woman he loves, so they're sleeping together, even though she's technically his legal mother. And the film, it's called Talai. I guess there's two different English translations of the title. The one I saw is Question of Honor, which came up with my version. But I've also seen it translated
Sorry.
as The Law, which, like, again, kind of fitting into this idea that this movie's an outlaw story. It's all about fighting back against these, societal laws, social laws that they have, where, yeah, the father can have you killed, or, can force you to marry somebody and not have much of a choice in it. Like, there's a couple lines talking about like, oh yeah, you'll learn to love him, just like I learned to love the husband I was basically forced to marry. And you realize Noama, she had no choice in the matter about marrying Saha's father. And you just feel like they're two youngish people who want to rebel in some way against these laws that are affecting their lives. So yeah, I think it's basically like an outlaw story.
Yeah, and like tying that to another movie, Tsukiyaki, which Mbeki was involved in the production, so carrying on that tradition.
That Senegal connection. And yeah, sorry.
And you mentioned the line where the mom said she learned to love her husband, and that like that's the first instance where I was like, oh, this is kind of like an Ozu movie.
Oh, that's a really good
Like the way it
comparison.
deals with
Yeah.
family and community, and like, some of the framing feels very Ozu, where it's like.
I feel like the very even from the very beginning, it's kind of feels like an Ozu, because like I can imagine the black and white shot of this person who has not been home in a while coming back to, his ruralish Japanese village, and like over, he's not announcing himself, but he's looking down on it from the hill, and then he, starts his like walk down. It's almost like a different kind of story going on in the Ozu version, where this person in my brain is like doesn't know that his fiance has been married to somebody else, but like you could see it playing out. And this is like we've cut all the fat off of any Ozu like musing or gazing on landscape or even a silly neighbor sideline story that he always has, like yeah.
Yeah, or
But
not.
totally, when you mentioned Ozu in your review on Letterboxd, I was like,
That
yeah,
makes a lot of
totally.
sense. That's a really good comparison. Like, both thematically, that kind of conflict between tradition and the changing present, and between the generations, like, that's very Ozu. And also, like, just sometimes the way things are shot, even though there's like a lot of camera movement, there's a sort of way that things are presented where it just feels like so head on that looks very Ozu in some cases. I didn't even think of that, but that's a really good comparison. Like, some of those close-ups where it's just like dead on, or you know, sometimes the way like both characters will just like walk into frame and it's this perfectly framed thing, like that feels very Ozu too. That's really great.
You know, at the end, there are some parts where like people are just like walking, it's like from someone's I guess like their yard area. Yeah. And like you see these people like walk by, and then the character will walk into the yard, and it's like, oh yeah, that's like it's a twist on like the Ozu, like shot of hallway, a person walks in the hallway, cut to, you know, cut to room where they're gonna walk into. It's like a stripped down, even like Joel, you were saying, like a stripped down version of like the Ozu way of editing things.
Everything, this story is, to go back to what you were talking about, Greek tragedy thing, I was, like, me and Sarah were saying, you know, it feels like a Shakespeare kind of like Hamlet type thing going on. But I really love how in that tight, like, 70 or 80, 81 minute runtime, it's like so much of that story gets laid out in a way where you're like, this happens, and then this happens, and this, like, it's just like a movie about causality for choices that people have made because they're going against the tradition, and it just lays it out brutally and hilariously sometimes, and yeah. Can we talk about the score?
Because it's not really the kind of score you would normally expect for any film. Like, it's this kind of jazzy soundtrack. I know, I think it's like Bill Higgins and David Williams were partly on it, and then another musician, Abdullah Ibrahim, who I wasn't as familiar with, but it's like a mixture of like Western and African kind of jazzy something going on. It's really interesting. I think even that also kind of made me think of like some of the, like, not exactly spaghetti Westerns, but there's something almost like Ennio Morricone in the kind of way that it's sort of weird and bouncy and just like not what you'd expect for, you know, in some ways, like, this film is kind of an epic, or, you know, at least a film with, like,
I mean, it feels like,
yeah, it. Like, it's a short epic, but it's an epic, and like just to have that kind of soundtrack with it, like, it's really interesting. It's not overdone either. Like, it's mostly at the beginning and the end, or like during the traveling scenes. You know, there's a couple of scenes where they play, but it's a lot of the film is done without any kind of background music.
Yeah, they even noticed that until all the very end, because like the main music is so good, like it kind of sticks with you the whole time. Like, it almost like pre solution of like you're hearing it the whole time. At least for me. I got that feeling.
Yeah.
And also, it feels like this is influence on Muhammad Salah Haroun.
Yeah.
In terms of just like this, the simplicity of everything, like the Ozu influence, like the fathers and sons. Like, it's kind of doing like a Haroun style story. Well, what he's going to do, this is before. Couple years before his first short film,
it might have been like even on the it might have been when we talked about Durat over on Flixwise, you might have said this would, I might have said this would make a good double feature with it, like that might have been where it came up, but because it, like, it also sort of dealing with like fathers and sons and violence and
but like Haroun would go for more like a political thing in this. I guess you could say this is political, but like
it feels more social than like international political kind of stuff we normally talk about with these films. Like, it feels like it's a comment about society and the sort of repercussions of going against society and societal values. Like, to me, that's more the focus than trying to make a more overtly political statement. Although, like, I think you could probably draw some political connections out of this. It's just, it feels like that's kind of secondary to what the film's interested in.
Right. I mean, you were saying that was a criticism people had anyways, not talking about certain things, which has always been a very weird criticism to me, like, because if you want to see a movie about that, you're going to be able to find it. Like, I made this movie about right. what I wanted to, right? But I was thinking, like, there is not really an authority figure except for the father. And then I guess that one of those men, I think, was, like, the village, like, elder
the
authority.
The guy seems to be, because, like, spying for the father, where he's, like, getting his nose in everybody's business. Yeah, like, exactly. Hey, where are you going? It's like, you want them to just say none of your business. But I guess, you know, when you're, like, the old patriarch, then, like, the society's kind of built around whatever you want, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting that way. But that almost makes me wonder what Saha went through, you know, in his 2 years of traveling or whatever, like what experiences on the outside he saw. Like, all we know is that he feels comfortable with the idea of leaving again, but everyone else is kind of like, that is crazy. Like, where would you go? You're supposed to be here with your father.
And going back to the Western outlaw thing, there's even the John Ford far-out shot that happens.
Oh, is that the shot when they go looking for Saha and there's like the two horses way up from above?
That
seems like very,
from way far away.
Yeah, it's like from a high angle looking down and you'd see these two horses kind of splitting off in two directions to look for it. Like, that felt very John Ford. And there's a couple things, like just the sort of desert landscape, the look of the gun. Like, to me, it had kind of that, you know, Western Badlands, a little bit of that sort of flavor, just, you know, partly through the setting, partly through the violence in the story. But it's not like a shoot 'em up action kind of movie. Like, I don't want to mislead people, but it just feels like there's a little bit of that influence somewhere in there.
Yeah, and like, even like when Saha returns at the end, it's a repeat of the same shot from the beginning, but this time he's holding a gun. So it has like that, like coming back for revenge type of feeling.
Yeah, exactly. Like, somebody's got to die in that scene at the end. Like, it basically turns into a showdown where, you know, he wants to see his mother who died, and everyone's going to find out that his brother didn't kill him, so like that's the big conflict that has to boil over.
You just reminded me of what I think was the funniest part, which is when his love is out searching after Saha has left the village after, you know, being quote unquote killed, and she goes to the hut. She's like, I'm looking for this man. He's tall and blah, blah, blah. And the guy's like, oh, yeah, I know who you're talking about. That guy's fucking crazy, violent as hell.
His girlfriend's
his,
like,
you know, whoever lives with like, him, hut is like, you're
what
an
does
idiot.
He say? Like, yeah, he tried to kill us. And she's like, no, he didn't, you coward. Like, his girlfriend just calls him out right there.
You're just a stupid coward.
Just makes fun of her boyfriend right there. Like, or her husband, I don't know, but the couple, I guess he scared them when he was on the run with the gun, and like he even shouted out to them like, hey, I'm just joking after, but it's just funny, like her description's so vague when they're immediately like, yeah, we saw that guy.
And it's like the thing a group of 5-year-olds would say, oh man, this guy was crazy. Like, no, he's just a homeless guy that yelled at you. Yeah, but you should have saw his eyes.
Yeah, that was really funny. And I don't, there's like a whole section where it's basically Saha hiding out with his aunt in a different village. And then eventually Noma goes to live with him, and they're kind of living in peace there. But it's like eventually that never lasts, you know, like it's again, that the sort of outlaw thing where like, you know, you find something and it should be peaceful, and like it just can't stay. Like, violence has to sort of creep back into the story by the end if you have unfinished business.
It's almost like the Bad Lieutenant Port of Call New Orleans ending, except it's not all, except, you know, it does have a tragedy at the end.
Okay, I thought you were gonna bring up Thieves Like Us with Shelley Duvall. I was like, I bet Spencer's going to bring it up, but I wasn't sure. Because that also has sort of a similar ending where, like, he dies and then she's pregnant, and it's sort of a similar kind of ending, right?
Similar-ish, yeah. That's not a favorite.
Okay,
movie.
I. All right.
It's like the end of season two of True Detective, right?
And for record, I didn't bring up Shelley Duvall first. It was a guest. Oh,
well, I was expecting it.
This is the first time it's happened.
He knows like, what you like.
What's Shelley Duvall, and how is she going to get worked into this episode? I was like, I bet it's going to be by bringing up thieves like us. So I was just waiting for it.
No, no, no.
He's got a cue card in it. It just says thieves like us written on it.
Okay. I didn't realize that was so much of the thing as it is. But, I mean, who doesn't love Shelley Duvall?
I know.
And I'll stop there, Joel, because you're going to get annoyed with it. I know.
I think she's a fantastic actress, but let's not get into it.
Okay. Okay, so the brother, like of all the characters that I kind of felt sorry for in the whole movie, the brother I really felt most sorry for because he was, you could say like he's kind of being a coward, but at the same time like he's stuck between, you know, his father,
yeah,
who's like a leader, and his brother who he loves, and like he. And like, do you guys think he made the right choice at the end by killing his brother?
I think like he made the choice that's what he felt obligated to do within the village and the society he was living. And like at that point, he can't live there anymore either, because everyone knows that he didn't kill his brother, so he just has to leave. And you know, it's going to become like ambiguous or like a mystery what even becomes of him after that. But like, you sort of feel like he has to by that point. It's almost not even his choice, but
yeah, I feel like him killing his brother right there, mm-hmm, was because he was so angry that he came back after he said he wasn't going to. It's like, you don't understand. If like he could have been, if you know, it was a different kind of movie, he could have been like, I have to kill you now because you're gonna die anyways. And sorry, here goes the Hell's Angels. I'm going to kill you now because I was supposed to do it anyways, and my life is already screwed up anyways. Why not? You know, like there's no way that Saha was going, yeah, to live after that point. You know?
And
although he is a
earlier on when they were trying to kill Saha while he was living in his hut just outside the village, when they were drawing straws, it's like the brother's reaction. It's almost, it's not that he doesn't want his brother to die, it's like, I don't want to be the one that has to do it, you know. He sort of already accepts like, yeah, this is something we have to do, and then he can't go through with it, so he lets him go at that crucial moment when he's got the knife and he stabs it right next to him and basically whispers for him to get out of there. But it's like, you know, he doesn't want to have to do this because it's his brother, but eventually it's like he basically has to by the end when he comes back.
This whole village has a real proximity problem where it's like, yeah, he's in that hut whispering to him like, hey, you can get out. And those guys are right outside. They can probably hear you. I mean, they don't end up, but... And then there was a part where the love interest and her sister were walking and they're like, oh, they'll never find out that we weren't actually where we were. It's like the entire village was right there. Like, you guys have to look around. It's a small village.
It's also, once they get... Once she leaves and goes looking for him, Noma, it doesn't take that long for him to just like run across her. I guess you could say like she might have guessed that he would go off to see his aunt or something like that, but he just basically like stumbles across her in the desert when she's dehydrated. Have you seen the movie Mongol by Sergei Bodorov? Yeah, it sort of reminded me of that scene where like there's this scene where this monk is like, okay, I'll deliver this message for you to Genghis Khan. He's like, you know, in return that someday you spare our monastery. And Genghis Khan agrees, and like the monk's gonna bring this message all the way to Genghis Khan's wife. And he's just like walking across the desert in his sandals, and eventually he just like drops over dead from dehydration like in the middle of the desert. But it just made me think of that scene. you know, when he comes across and finds her, but
yeah.
One thing that I did bring up earlier was just like how simple it all appears. Mm-hmm. Like this does like a like this is a movie where you watch it and you and like if like like your first thought was like, oh, I could do this, but then you watch more of it and you're like no, I couldn't.
Yeah, it's like, deceptively it's so simple. Like it takes a lot of effort to boil everything down like into its barest elements. Because on one hand, I feel like you could probably summarize the film in like a paragraph, but on the other hand, I feel like you couldn't summarize it at all in a paragraph because there's so many things that you realize are packed into like a very tight runtime. You know, I feel like, yeah, you know, that must have been Idrissa Udago's method. It's just like, how do I boil this down more? How do I fit two scenes into one scene? How do I fit, you know, one scene into a line of dialogue? How do I turn a line of dialogue into a look? And it has that kind of feel where it's like everything's just sort of condensed into its simplest form.
I've seen one other Drago movie. I have three. Oh, and I haven't gotten to
was
yet.
It Yabe?
But I have okay. That one, but I haven't
I've seen that yet. One. That one's really good, that too. It's like the girl who befriends the witch, like the village's old, not like magic witch, but like wise weird woman kind of witch. That film's really good and really sad also. And that was the one that came right before this.
I've seen the one after this, Samba Traore.
Okay.
Traore, something like that, which is a similar thing. A man comes back to town, and he stole money from a bank. It's set in modern times, and he's somewhere in a bank, and like the whole time, like, you know, the police are gonna catch up to him eventually, and it's like him trying to just like fix up his village, and it's like kind of similar hyenas where it's like someone rich comes back and they like kind of fix things up and they spend money and stuff like mm-hmm. that, and but there's still that air of like, well, it's all gonna catch up to you at some point,
yeah,
and like you know the ending, like from the beginning, but it plays a similar things. It's also like maybe 85 minutes.
Okay.
And it does that super simple strip down, like looks like pure, like down to like the bare essentials to get everything across.
That sounds really good too. Is that one on YouTube or do you get that one on DVD?
I spent money on it on a DVD.
I might have to do the same. Sometimes it's just like, I don't know, if you can find a good copy, it's great. it's hard to find good copies for these films sometimes. Like,
there are French DVDs, but yeah, that's kind of the only option you have.
That's one thing too, like we should maybe mention, like, Idrissa Udago, he's not obscure, I think he's just obscure here, you know what I mean? Like, I think he's definitely appreciated in France, in Africa. I know he studied filmmaking partly in Soviet Union, so I'm not sure if, I don't know if maybe Russia today, like if people might see his movies or if there's some other connection. I don't, it stood out in my mind because like again, Alexei German gravitated towards this film, but like I think there's definitely places where, you know, he was recognized, and it's just like for whatever reason, I think maybe not North America. Because, like you said, there, you know, the DVD's in French, and there's more written about him in French, it seems like. There's not that much in English. So I think it's more like, you know, if he's obscure, yeah, he's obscure here, not necessarily everywhere. I mean,
that seems to be the trend with African directors, I've noticed, at least the ones I... Like they're popular in France and Africa and kind of everywhere else but North America. It's like for some reason they don't translate to North America. Even like I'm Not a Witch, which I thought would be kind of a bigger deal, because like I'm not the biggest fan of it necessarily, but I still really like it and respect it. But even that, like I thought that had like the most universal like appeal of the recent movies, but still, it's like, how did that not even translate to like North
Yeah.
America?
I mean, partly I think like some of the
Okay.
filmmakers we talked about, like oh my God, I'm getting tongue-tied. Mahamat Saleh Haroun, like he speaks French and he works partly in France, so like there's a French connection there. It's not like he's making films in Hollywood. So like I can see why some filmmakers like that would have more of a presence in France, but
But it's like the woman who did I'm Not a Witch is Welsh and
yeah, that's
Zambian,
true, yeah.
so it's like on that note, Joel, before we started this podcast, were you familiar with African films at all, like before we started doing like Tuki Buki and all that other stuff?
I'm trying to think if I've even like in the few film classes I took, if we watched anything, but I'm not sure. District 9.
Yeah, that counts.
I mean, I guess it counts, but
Neil Blomkamp is South African. That counts.
mean, black African film is, I feel like, a different thing.
Yeah.
Like, I probably have seen some things from like Egypt, more of that in like the northern part. But yeah, definitely nothing like we've been watching for the podcast. At least not that I can
I think
remember.
partly like there aren't a lot of African films that are canonized. Like it's hard enough to get recognition for something like a movie like Black Girl or films like that getting released through Criterion. There was that whole like, oh, Criterion only has like four black filmmakers or whatever that was sort of recently. There was like some kind of
Yeah, it's for African American
or African
filmmakers.
American. Okay, I knew it was something like that, but I know people were talking about that recently. Like it's hard to get that basic recognition. So it's like of course people aren't gonna hear about these films and see about these films if if they're not on those lists, if they're not
Latinos.
getting mentioned. Kino does a much better job with that. It's true. Like they put out Hyenas on the Blu-ray recently. Yeah, and it looks
Blu-ray, yeah.
fantastic. And
And it's on Netflix, not Netflix, it's on Amazon Video right now for rent or to
yeah,
buy.
I'm still waiting for somebody to put Shala or Xala on Blu-ray. I don't know. There's so many Sido, like fairly well-known films that I think just like they don't get cleaned up yet, or you want to see them have a good release that can excite people. And I don't know, like that there are films that already exist that if they had that support behind them, I think would go a long way in people appreciating them.
There's only so much Martin Scorsese can do,
Right.
and luckily, I almost pre-ordered it, but I don't have enough money to justify it to myself. But Salai O, the
Oh, Soleil.
Medhundo,
Soleil.
Hundo,
Oh, yeah.
yeah, Salai O. Okay, there we go. Is gonna be on the next what's that thing?
The World
The
Cinema,
Scorsese.
yeah.
It's the next one coming out in a few weeks as of this
Yeah,
recording.
I think
You can pre-order
the
it.
first one had Tuki Buki in it, right? Yeah, no, those are really great sets. I'm glad they're still doing them.
Yeah. And
But
back to to lie. I liked Now, this is like a minor thing, but I like just seeing all the animals,
yeah.
and like you get a real sense of like this is a real full-fledged community. And luckily, luckily there's no graphic on-screen animal
No,
slaughter
it's implied they eat a
in
goat,
this.
but you don't see any goat slaughter.
Yeah.
Well, but it's so funny too, and she's like, "That's a pretty scrawny goat," and he's like, oh, why don't you slaughter? The look on her face is just priceless, you know? Like, that goat's gonna get eaten.
Yeah, Joel, I'm glad there was nothing too graphic for you, because I know you have had a big issue with it.
Yeah, I would hate to have to drive to Delaware just to hit you in the face or something.
Okay. Don't watch Camp Theroy. There's a goat slaughter in that one.
All
but
right.
It's thematic to the movie, but it's still very unexpected. It shows up.
Yeah, I got your thematic stuff right here.
Okay, but it...
You can't see me waving my fist.
Okay. Yeah, just like seeing all the animals and like seeing like how like they're a part of the community and I'm a home health aide, and like one of my clients, I drive by a goat farm every day. So like seeing all the goats was like, oh, this feels like the drive to work. And I always like slow down near a goat farm and take pictures if there's traffic is slow enough.
Both the animals and also just all these kind of tangible things that people are doing that make it feel lived in and real. Like, you know, you see him laying the bricks for the building, or you see the grandmother, or I think it's Saha's mother, like making fabric or making clothes, and like you really see how it's done. And I think partly when you do a film like this that's a period film, you can also work in ways to preserve certain traditions or put them on screen in a way that the film doesn't have to be about them like a documentary, but they can just be a part of that world and a part of that background. Like, have you seen a Canadian film, Antonin Jouet, The Fast Runner, Inuit film?
Oh, I know of it, but I haven't seen it.
Like, that's like totally different culture, but it sort of reminded me of this, and like that's depicting a time of life before white people showed up. And part of that film, like, even though it's telling a story that in some ways like similar, like there's a scene where I think the Antonin Jouet's second wife, he marries the first wife and it's fine, and then he marries the second one and things start getting bad, and the second wife has her brother and his goons try to murder Antonin Jouet while he's sleeping, and he escapes at the last minute, and there's this big chase scene. But like there's maybe a couple similarities, but that film, you see like a lot of traditional practices are kind of documented by just being a part of the story that's set at a different time period, which is something I always appreciate when I watch historical films or period films. And like there's something about Telai that feels very timeless, even though like I think you could probably narrow it down if you wanted, but if it doesn't feel like in this year, and that's, you know, whatever the history was at that particular moment. Instead, it's more just setting a story in the past and kind of painting a picture in this almost romanticized way, which is partly why I thought a little bit of Terrence Malick, his early films like Badlands and Days of Heaven. Even like the Days of Heaven even also has this sort of it's not actually incest, but in that case it's like the Richard Gere's pretending to be the brother, and then it sort of boils over and it leads to violence, you know. There's some sort of commonality there I could probably pinpoint if I had more time to think about it. But you know, this whole idea of like the kind of love triangle boiling over into violence just to set a story in the past around that, to me seemed a little bit similar in some ways.
Yeah, and with this there's like the last actually it might come out around the same time. But in the Cairo Station episode, I mentioned Cairo Station vaguely feels like Gate of Flesh a little bit in certain ways. And there's another Gate of Flesh connection where, and Gate of Flesh, like one of the women is shamed and like tied up in public to be like mocked. And this has like the same thing of, how to say her name? But, like the
I have a hard time with it.
Noma,
too.
And she gets tied up to a post and publicly shamed. Mm-hmm. But yeah, there's my theory. out of late gate, a flesh connection. I don't have much else to say besides it's just like, oh, Arbor, but the donkeys. And like seeing the brother on a donkey, like he looks so goofy because he's like too tall for it, the way he rides on it.
His leg, like he's got to point his legs forward so they don't drag. I noticed that too.
Yeah, like he looks like just like kind of like a Joel Embiid, although Joel Embiid's from a different part of Africa, but like this tall lanky guy who has to like, but like he's just so tall lanky he has to like ride on the back of the donkey and look so goofy. But it's just such a great visual every single time you see it.
Yeah, I definitely like one of my favorite characters who's just in it for the three seeds is the guy who shows up with the donkey to give Noah a ride. Like he hardly has anything to say, and I don't know, him just going by on this donkey and he's like, hey, want a ride? And he's so smooth somehow. And I don't know, we already mentioned it, but he's like, yes, okay, I understand, goodbye. Like his farewell is just kind of perfect. And then of course when Noma sees him later on and like they make that eye contact, and I think like Sa kind of already figures that something went on between them when like the story that she told him doesn't match up at all with like what he sees. And he's like, oh, I bet something went down here. But I don't know, I just, that whole little subplot I liked.
And as I mentioned earlier, but the little sister is great.
Yeah.
It's a nice little addition of like, a kid, like being a kid. And Joel, any last final thoughts about Talai? Would you recommend it?
Well, sure, I'd recommend it, but I don't really have anything additional to say. I think it is funny that you, Spencer, your reaction was like a gut punch at the end still, because I even things like the scene when the brother has to go murder Saha, you know, he's the one who gets chosen to, and those two guys are taking him to the hut with the torches, and they pass by the guy, the father, who's getting ready to hang himself, and they just kind of casually mention, what's he doing? Oh, he's gonna hang himself, okay, and they just move on, and you hear the bucket being kicked off screen. But it's so like, it's I guess it could be shocking, but it comes off as really silly, because it's like oh, my daughter disgraced the entire family, well, just go hang myself, you know. No, nobody's like, oh, please don't. It's just like, yeah, it's just what
there's
you
something,
do.
Like, so frustrating about those societal rules that they live in. Like, even the fact that it doesn't really paint, like, it's interesting that it doesn't paint the father as a villain character, but it's like there's something really messed up in how he can just take this young woman who, like, should be marrying his son, and he, like, marries her instead, and how that ripples throughout the story. You know, it's like, it's tragic that it's a story about characters sort of rebelling against that, and you know, in the end basically kind of getting crushed for it to some degree or another. But you know, I think like this film, the view that it has, it's ambivalent towards certain traditions and certain values, I guess, historic values. So I don't, it's really interesting in that way. It's not necessarily like everything traditional is good. Like, it, on one hand, it clearly has a love for the history and the past, but it's also critical of certain things. You know, the lack of autonomy that young people have, I think that's a big part of it.
And it's, again, like, it's boiled down to like 80 minutes, which I'm not saying like runtime has to be like 80 minutes, but like this is an example of like, this is like the perfect example of, yeah, how you can like tell like a complete story in 80 minutes.
Yeah, I think most people assume that when you hear a film's less than 90 minutes, it has to be like frivolous in some way. You know, that's not the case at all. It could be very substantial and very, like, this is a rich experience watching the film, but it's, Yeah, it's just extremely economically told. And I thought the Ozu comparison was really good. I'm thinking more about that. I'm gonna keep thinking about it. Even the way certain things are kind of left off screen. That I don't, like, I was thinking a little bit Bressan earlier, but I think Ozu is a much better point of comparison. So I'm gonna rewatch it again with that in mind.
Now you say that, I assume Paul Schrader probably loves this movie then.
Yeah, there's not really a Carl Theodore Dreyer element to this movie, is there? Maybe not.
Maybe not. But 2/3 of things that Paul Schrader loves.
Yeah, this definitely feels like it would fit right in with that, like, transcendental style of film kind of analysis.
So this there's a DVD out there. You can find it other
Yeah, YouTube,
places.
Canopy. Weird DVD that you have to order from Europe and that takes you a month to get here if you're like me. But yeah, there's easier
Yeah,
ways to
you
watch
rent
it
it for a
now.
while
So,
too.
like, I think just like when I found out about the movie, it was literally like right before he died, so it was kind of a like, oh my God. And I think just the fact that he died set off some people to kind of look back, and now, like, it's maybe gotten a little bit easier to, like, I think his movies were made a little bit more available after that. I watched this, like, clip on YouTube that was a little bit of a retrospective after he died, and they showed, in Burkina Faso, like, they put up a statue of him, and you can tell he was a big deal there. So, and, like, rightly, I think he should be a big deal everywhere, but that's why we're talking about it, I guess.
And last I checked, he was not in the Oscars in memoriam segment, but whatever.
Come
They
on.
always miss a couple huge
They always miss a lot.
ones.
I think, like, they don't usually do
You, I,
international cinema either. Like, they're very focused on, like,
yeah.
Hollywood, and this feels far away from Hollywood. Like, I think probably, Oscar people, they wouldn't even know what he looked like to put together the In Memoriam,
Jay Dog, you were saying something?
Yes, I was saying that it would. I would, if this had been in, if him he Joel Brain.
Joel Brainbetter.
Anyway, yes, Oscars. You can't expect the Oscars to
To get right.
show any sort of sense of outside the world,
Yeah, it depends. Like, because I
outside the US.
just watched Seven Beauties, which I'm kind of obsessed with now, and Fernando Rey was in Oscar In Memoriam. So they get sometimes foreign people, not
Sometimes
always.
a non-Hollywood person slips in there, but, like, to me, the
It has to be like a
Oscars,
big deal. Like,
yeah. Like, the Oscars to me are always like a Hollywood kind of, oh, sorry, I keep talking over you.
it has to be like someone to level of like for Fernando Rey or like Fellini or like
I think if it's a slow year,
okay.
not enough people dropped off. Who else might have gone?
But the Oscars, I always take it as just like Hollywood's own little celebration of itself. So I don't take it that seriously as far as, like, celebrating international cinema. It's not really the best for that. Like, there's other festivals, there's other awards that I think are better to look at as far as representing what's going on in international film. Like, the Oscars, it's always kind of a surprise to me when something like, oh, hey, Parasite actually got, like, Oscars attention. What happened? How did that happen? Like, I always assume it's gonna just be stuff like that will just be ignored,
But yeah, not it doesn't matter. Just like to see another example of like, wow, even in 2019, the Oscars still can't still can't like acknowledge that much foreign
Yeah.
cinema.
One thing I wanted to mention that didn't really come up, the character Saha, and, like, the actor, he's not that young, which I thought was kind of interesting in some ways. Like, he has all those gray hairs, and it's in some ways, like, this is I don't know, like, genre, angry young man kind of genre film. But to have him basically be middle-aged, it to me just sort of feels like it kind of rubs your face in the missed opportunity in his life that's kind of taken away by having a father who can basically, you know, marry the woman that his son wants, and, you know, in some ways that restricts the opportunities of a younger generation. And I always think, like, you see sometimes in these like polygamist communities, like Mormons, you have like one old fart at the top who marries all these young women, and they push out the young men because that's like competition for them, and deliberately sort of alienate them in those communities. Or I don't know, like I think there's something about that patriarchal domination in the film that's really interesting, and just the fact that, you know, the son Saha, like he's already like middle-aged by the time we're watching this film. He's like on the younger end of things, but he's not like the rebellious young guy in his early 20s. Like he's a man, and it's like, he still has to rebel against his dad. I don't know, that's sad, but that's just one more thing I wanted to mention.
Yeah, like this movie is full. Like, I feel like if I watch this like a third time, there, I don't know for a fact if I watch it a third time, I'll notice even more. Mm-hmm. But Joel, you and I have recommended other 1990 movies before. Do you feel like going over them again, or not really?
I say stick with Hardware. Okay. You know, the. Was that Richard Stanley movie?
Yeah.
It's, which I can't decide whether rewatching it is a good idea or a bad idea, because no, it's just a really interesting sci-fi horror movie. But it has a special place in my heart because it was the first episode of Please Don't Send Me an Outer
Space. I really like that movie. Does that count as African cinema? Because Richard Stanley's from South Africa? I don't know.
It's got that big chunk in the desert too in the beginning. Yeah, I don't know either.
Okay. No, I see.
it's got right. William Hookins in it. I don't know.
I don't know, Predator 2, but. Better case for Predator 2.
Oh, I love Predator 2. It's the bait pig in the city of the Predator franchise. It's weirder, more intense, more unpredictable. It's kind of a perfect sequel in how it expands everything outwards without repeating the first one. I love Predator 2. I have a different 1990 film I was going to mention, but Predator 2 is a good one. I was going to mention the movie Twilight from 1990 by Georgi Fay here, which is... he worked a lot with Bellator, and sadly, Georgi Fay here passed away when he was still fairly young. But Twilight, it's like a murder mystery. I think it's sort of loosely inspired by... it's almost like a remake of M in some ways. Or I think it's partly inspired by the real killer that M was based on, the Fritz Lang M. But... it's a really dark, it's basically like, if you like Bellator films, check out Georgi Fehér's films, because it's like, oh, these are basically two Bellator films I've never seen before. Twilight's the first feature film, I think. He might have had some shorts in between, or he might have had some other stuff, but like, you know, the way they're shot, that slow, long take style, they're very similar. They're maybe less philosophical than Bellator stuff, and more like in that film noir kind of territory, but Twilight, it's like a murder mystery, and it's really dark and intense. It makes True Detective look like you know, Disney show. the other film he did, Passion, before he died, it's kind of like a Postman Rings Twice sort of a story. It might have even had been based on it, I forget now, but that's the later 90s one. So Twilight, not to be confused with the Robert Pattinson Shining Vampire movie, Georgi Fehér's Twilight from 1990. I think, I don't know why I thought of that when I was watching Talai. I think maybe just there's sort of like a mixture of sense of humor and really dark subjects, or maybe it's the fact that it's a filmmaker who's kind of overlooked. But yeah, that would be my recommendation. Twilight and Predator 2. So there you go.
Okay. Okay, I found one that I forgot to mention. For my site, Jailhouse701, Japanese Cult Cinema, I reviewed the Juzo Tommy film Tales of the Golden Geisha, 1990. It's probably at the lower end of his movies. I don't like it as much as the rest, but still interesting. It's his satire of like politics and like the politics and banking at the time. It's a little too specifically Japanese. So I don't think it's supposed to have that same appeal as Tampopo, but still is, it's still a good movie. And if you're into like Itami sensibility, check it out. But for me, it's the one I like the least of his films. And a month or two ago, I was going through Cynthia Rothrock movies, and there are two from this year: China O'Brien, which is great.
Oh, that's so much fun.
And Martial Law, which is
It's okay. Yeah, fine. I mean, I like the stuff she did in Hong Kong better than the stuff she did in America, but I think that has more to do with just was China O'Brien like a was it like a Golden Harvest film shot in the United States? I forget now. One of them was.
It's Robert Klaus China O'Brien. So
I might be getting them mixed up a bit, but like I always think of like Yes, Madam and that sort of period with her. But it's too bad because she should have been like at least on par with somebody like Jean-Claude Van Damme. You know, her ability to act and her martial arts. Like I think she should have had more star power than she was, or you know, I think she had more star potential than she was treated with Cynthia Rothrock. And I don't know, like to me, some of those action guys from that period are like, it's a total mystery to me how they became successful. Like Steven Seagal, I can't stand Steven Seagal. I would much rather watch Cynthia Rothrock. So, yeah.
As I said, another episode, which might come out around this time, I forgot which one, but I think the reason she's not in Expendables is because Stallone knows she could actually kick his ass in real life. I think it's purely his ego. He doesn't want someone like her to like show him up.
Well, are there any women in the Expendables movies?
The MMA lady, one of them, Ronda Rousey.
Oh, might be the other one. I think you're right. Maybe she's in the third one, or
Gina Carano.
I think it's probably Ronda Rousey. I feel like Gina Carano, I've seen her in stuff, but I don't think she was in Expendables. She was like in, what was she in? Deadpool and the Soderbergh film, Livewire, and... The Mandalorian. Movies from that time period.
The Mandalorian too. No, wait.
Saving Baby Yoda.
Yeah, but start with the guest. This will come out late September, early October. What's got going on, Martin?
I think most recent podcast episode I've had go up, it's about the film Deep End. I had guest Matthias van der Roost, which people probably know if you're in the same film Twitter circles as us. We talked about Deep End. I think coming up, for sure, I have an episode on Martin Scorsese's After Hours. I have an episode on the Ringu films coming up. I know there's a big Christmas episode in the works that I have coming up that should be a lot of fun, talking about Tim Burton Batman movies. So lots to look forward to if you want to check me out over at flicksoys.com. And just for any updates, I usually post them on my Twitter at MovieKessler.
Any films coming up, or pandemic can't stop all of that?
I'm trying to get work done. I'm not sure there's anything I can plug right now, but hopefully in the near future I'll have some more to say.
Okay. Joel, you? What's going on?
First episode of the Dead Travel Fast podcast is actually on the internet. It's on iTunes and Podbean, and I'll be pushing it to other places. But and the other episodes I'll have edited and up soon, and then we will resume recording. This is more of a message for Spencer. But if somebody wants to listen to us talk about...
I almost found someone for Transfiguration, but they are too busy for it. But that's...
Yeah, I agree. They are too busy for it. So that's up. If you want to hear us talk about Which vampire movies.
Dracula 1931 is our first episode.
Yes. And the other podcast I've been working on, which is now titled Amazon Told Me To, just like, you know, God told me to, because when I was referring to it as customers also watched, I didn't realize that there was already a podcast called that, because when I came up with that originally, there wasn't a podcast called that. But hey, you snooze, you lose. And I kind of like Amazon Told Me To because it sounds creepy. But, I'll have episodes of that up pretty soon. Had the guests, I'm drawing a blank. Dave? Wow. Yeah, I had Dave Stone Rob, and I had the guy who does, Just Enough Trope podcast, whose name is, I'm looking it up, hold on a second, sorry. I don't want to be super rude. His name is Aaron Coker. Yeah, he's got a whole podcast network.
I know that. Well, I know.
Yeah.
Okay.
We talked about four movies in a chain from the customers always watch section of Amazon Prime, and it was a lot of fun. It was a fun time for all of us, I think, and conversations. Stretching from Train to Busan to a bunch of low budget stuff, because that's the way Amazon works. So I'm looking forward to getting that up and possibly having some other people join me.
If Mr. you ever Kessler want somebody who's watched all the terrible Amazon Bigfoot documentaries and UFO documentaries, just let me know.
Oh, hell yeah. Yeah. Anyways, yeah. So look forward to Amazon Told Me To coming soon to an earbud near you.
All right. For me, I was on Grindbin. I recorded Grindbin on Street Trash, one of my favorite body horror movies. But I kind of don't like that genre at all. And that's one of the few I actually like. Which I know, don't give me shit. I know it's stupid, but I genuinely do enjoy that movie. But that should be coming out at some point, and I've been a Grindman a few times. One talking about Ralph Bakshi's Coonskin. That was like 3 years ago or something like that. And I was on talking about the Jalo In the Folds of the Flesh. And also check out the Grindman. They're good guys. And they've been on here a couple times for the Wesley Snipes episode and the Fred Williamson episode. And by this time, hopefully, the first few articles in my African history site blog thing will be up. It depends if I get too crazy into research, which might happen. And what else? In the Jailhouse 701 Japanese Cult Cinema might be back with something, but I'm not sure. So so look out for that, all that stuff. And coming out around this time will be Platoon and an episode on Cairo Station, which is on Netflix currently. You can watch that on Netflix. Sex Lives and Videotape. So look out for those around this time, unless they have been released already. Martin, thank you for coming on.
Thank you for having me. I'm glad this episode worked out. This was a film I was looking forward to talking about for a long time.
Oh yeah, and any excuse to talk about African films, I will take. And if you're wondering because this will be the last African film we discuss, if you're wondering, why did we not talk about Simban this whole season? Well, because he'll show up on next season, because I found an excuse to tie him into the theme for next season. So look out for that when I make the official announcement for what next season will be. And J-Dog, thank you for being a good co-host.
Yeah, I mean, you're paying me, right?
Yeah, bye.
Cool.
Okay.
The show's email is highandlowpod@gmail.com. It made no sense to change email, so it's the same feed. The show can be found at podbean.com, and Spotify, and other places you can find podcasts. Please rate and review whenever possible. The logo is by Josh Hollis. The music is by James Fell, and thank you for listening.